Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. An article in Washington Monthly caught our attention. It's a very long essay in the November-December issue, How to Make Conservatism Great Again. It isn't just establishment Republicans who lost to Donald Trump. It's the conservative intellectual class, the reformicons, who presciently warned that traditional GOP policies were not helping working-class voters whose own new ideas never really caught on. We'll talk about those ideas during the course of this hour with the man who wrote the long piece, and he is Philip Longman. Philip is senior editor of the Washington Monthly, senior research fellow with the New America Foundation, as well as a lecturer at Johns Hopkins, where he teaches healthcare policy. He has written all kinds of articles for the Monthly, and his work has appeared in the Atlantic Monthly as well, the Financial Times, Foreign Affairs, and Harvard Business Review. He also was a senior writer and deputy assistant managing editor at U.S. News and World Report. He has won many awards for his business and financial writing and investigative journalism. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Philip. Here's how you join our conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Philip, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be here, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it should be a really good conversation. You write about the aftermath of Mitt Romney's defeat, and there was focus for a little while on a network of conservative writers in their 30s, reformish conservatives, reformicon, they were called by the New York Times a little bit later. Who are these reformicons, and what were they espousing?
Well, it was a small group of policy intellectuals. As you say, most of them were in their 30s. I guess they still are mostly in their 30s.
No.
they were people who identified with the conservative movement, but who realized that conservative policies or Republican policies were not serving the interests of the working class very well. And proposed to do something about it. So they spent much of the last 4 years crafting various policy proposals that they thought would help benefit, people, that working class people, and trying to sell them to the Republican Party, put these ideas into the platform of the party. And today, you have to say that most of that work is moot, in the sense that the party paid no attention. And also, in my article, I'm sort of at pains to show that most of these ideas really were completely inadequate to the problem, that there's something much more fundamental that conservatives need to do to break free of certain false notions that have kind of corrupted thinking on the right for a very long time now. I wrote this piece before the election, but I think it's actually even more germane today, because the future of conservatism has just never been more in play than it is as we speak right now.
I think the future of everything is pretty much in play, isn't it?
Right.
We have no idea where we're going. You write quite a bit about antitrust laws, and I wonder what's happened to antitrust laws, when they were at their peak, how that helped the Sam's Club voters, and why it is that it seems like they're just totally abandoned. It's hard to imagine very much antitrust legislation that's been brought forward for years now.
Right. Well, this is the story of what happened to antitrust is one that I think is key to understanding how we got here as a nation. And so, and it's really a forgotten history. Or a very distorted history. So, I think most people, when they hear the word antitrust, it's a very weird word. Like, who's against trust, right? I mean, antitrust. Sounds
right.
Weird. But, there's a And most people, if they remember their high school history class, right, if they associate with anything, they'd probably associate it with Teddy Roosevelt,
right,
who famously busted the truss, right? And this all happened more than 100 years ago in most people's understanding of things. But actually, there was a very powerful anti-monopoly movement that existed in the United States well into the 19th century, and it actually reached its climax in the 1960s, and in many ways was so successful in producing mass prosperity, a gigantic middle class, right, that people took it for granted, and almost literally sort of wrote it out of history. So part of what I hope maybe we can do in this hour is spend a little time just going back and recovering some of that history so we can understand how we got here.
Mm-hmm.
But the long and the short of it is that the problems that so many Americans are facing today, particularly in middle America, in heartland America, in small town America, in rural America, right, have their origins in a retreat from policies that, until about the 1980s, had been extremely effective at equalizing economic opportunity regionally, of containing monopolies that had the effect of hollowing out local communities and destroying opportunities for entrepreneurship.
It really changed the whole makeup of those communities, right, in terms of banks, in terms of small businesses. They're all these huge Walmart kinds of corporations. Banks are now huge conglomerates.
Right. And see, so what was surprising to many people to know is that before the 1970s, for example, Walmart and most of its business practices would have been flat out illegal. It was illegal to run a corporation the way Walmart does, let alone Amazon. So, to give you an example, in the 1960s, early 1960s, there were two supermarket chains in Los Angeles metropolitan area that wanted to merge. And when they proposed this merger, the antitrust division of the Justice Department said, no, that's impossible. We will not allow this merger because after you are done merging, this new entity will control 7% of the grocery sales in the Los Angeles metropolitan area. And that it was the law of the land that if two grocery stores together controlled a mere 7% of a market, that would be a monopoly and illegal, and we would break that up. How times have changed. So in about half the metropolitan areas in the United States today, Walmart controls more than half the grocery sales, right?
That high, so, wow.
Yeah, right. And they also, Walmart also engages in business practices that were flat out illegal into the 1970s. Practices like loss leading, selling products for less than it costs you to buy them in order to buy growth and buy a market share and put your rivals out of business, or demanding and getting favorable pricing from some of your suppliers due to your volume. These kind of things were illegal, and were illegal for a good reason, because generations of Americans, including, importantly, conservative, free market-oriented Americans, understood that any market structure had a tendency towards consolidation and monopoly, and that one needed to take positive action to ensure that that didn't happen. So we had all kinds of laws in place to make sure that we didn't have these kinds of concentrations of ownership we have today. That didn't mean we stopped progress, right? In the 1960s, lots of little mom-and-pop shops lost out to the AMP supermarket, right? We took advantages of new technologies and new business practices, but we did that in the context of ensuring that competition continued to exist between these different enterprises in a market so that we didn't have monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
And that had, well, it's a long story about how it came to be that we fell away from that.
Well, let's hear that story. But, what happened in the 70s?
Okay. Well, there was a lot of different forces that came together. It was not something that was brought to you by one party or another. Both liberals and conservatives in the 1970s participated in the dismantling of all these antitrust and fair trade laws. And when I say dismantling, I don't mean that they were repealed. Most of these laws are still on the books. They're just not enforced.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So part of the context in which that happened is inflation. People were worried about inflation. And economists were saying, well, you know, if we deregulated more, we can get prices down. So we did that with airlines in the late 1970s. We did that with banking. And people thought that what they were going to get from that was lower prices. And unfortunately, with monopolies, sometimes you get lower prices in the long run, but in the long run, you get enslavement. And so it has not worked out well over the long term. But the fear of inflation is one big part of the reason that happened. The other big thing, I think, is the intellectual capture, the cognitive capture of the economics profession, academic economics, many of the think tanks. One of the things that's just really amazing to me is when you go back into the 1950s and 60s and look at how conservatives then talked about monopoly, right? The people who are today remembered as the founding fathers of the modern libertarian movement, the people that just recreated conservatism, right, as in the 20th century. If you go back and look at what they were actually saying back in the 50s and 60s, they were talking about how the absolute importance of rigorous antitrust, because without antitrust, monopoly would make sure that no market would ever be efficient. It could never have real competition, right?
Mm-hmm.
So gradually what happened, though, is that the institutions to which those folks graduated or found themselves working, right, in the various think tanks, the various academic departments, most famously, I suppose, is the University of Chicago Economics Department, which sort of pioneered so much of this deregulation, built the intellectual case for it. Those people became dependent on corporate financing, and over time they were gradually captured by their funders.
Mm.
And
then, of course, as you move on, you have both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party who don't want to enforce all of this because they're getting huge campaign contributions from those very entities, aren't they?
Well, that's right. I mean, even as we speak, right, the Democratic Party is very beholden to gigantic platform monopolies like Google.
Right.
Right? So there's a certain amount of caution about talking about, well, maybe Google has too much power. and the Republican Party, too. So we have each party tends to be in under the control of different monopolies, but more and more it's monopoly. And by the way, the other thing that's happened in people up until about 2 years ago, I think even most pretty well-informed people just had no idea, right, at how the degree of concentration that had built up in the economy. So, but now we are at levels, where you're talking about everything from coffins to beer to healthcare to banking to airlines, agriculture, wherever you look. Right, you're looking at degrees where two or three companies have 80 or 90% of market share, right? Which would be per se illegal throughout most of the history of the United States. But there's been no prosecution of these things, right? And even today, under the sort of new or under the legal standards that have been in effect since the 1970s about when do we prosecute, the only way you can bring an antitrust suit basically is if you catch people conspiring to raise prices, right? And, and short of that, you know, the case won't be made. So that's mostly what I'm here to say, right? Is that the lack of these lack of enforcement of these policies, right? Which is not a liberal or a conservative idea. It's just American idea, right? Is largely responsible for the hollowing out of these middle class generally, but also of middle America, of so much of it, right? And that, in turn, has created the social isolation, the downward mobility, the grievances, the anger, you know, that has fed the support for Trump and Trumpism. Until we deal with that problem, you know, we're going to be dealing with an ever more problematic polity.
And if you put this in the Senate in 2016, you write about this alliance that could take place, and we've heard it before. People like Bernie Sanders have said, I'll work with Donald Trump if he can really address what ails the people in this country who aren't doing very well. But you mentioned liberal partners with conservative partners in decentralizing economic power. So we have, as you call her, Senate progressive firebrand like Elizabeth Warren and Tea Party champions like Mike Lee talking along remarkably similar lines about the dangers of economic concentration.
Well, that's right. And so people are stumbling to this truth through different paths. They're getting there different ways, but they're winding up in the same place. And they look around and it's like, oh my God, right? Whether you're representing Massachusetts or Utah. So that's kind of exciting, and that's good. And it's also true that the new Trump administration, as opposed to the Trump campaign, is very much up for grabs. I mean, nobody quite knows who's going to be in it and what its policies are going to be. But there is the opportunity for Trump or the Trump administration to take some of these concerns seriously and to do good things along those lines. And, you know, there Trump has himself at different times made statements that would suggest that, well, maybe he kind of gets some of this, even though he hasn't emphasized it much in his talk.
So the new hats would have to say, making conservatism great again. Right? Instead of making conservatism great. Let's welcome phone calls for you. Our guest this hour has written a long essay and a very interesting one for the November-December issue of Washington Monthly. Philip Longman is senior editor, senior research fellow with the New America Foundation, and a lecturer at Johns Hopkins, where he teaches healthcare policy. We're talking about Republicans, intellectual group of conservatives who warned some time ago that traditional GOP policies were not helping working class voters. They had some ideas about how to change this, starting with enforcing antitrust, which has really changed the landscape of America in terms of how our communities operate, how much money people are making, how much things cost, and he believes that it needs to be enforced and has been calling on that for quite some time. They also, we'll talk a little bit about this too, they also looked at allowing people who are in areas where jobs have been lost to give them a stipend to move to areas where there are jobs, that may help some people. And we'll look at other ideas that this group of intellectuals have had and the influence they may have in the Republican Party right now, if any. Our phone number, join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter is at K Dunn Show. We've talked an awful lot about what's happened with corporations and income inequality on this program for many, many years now, but haven't paid a whole lot of attention to antitrust. So is this a piece that needs our deep attention? To you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls. Chris in Winona, our first caller for you. Philip, hello, Chris.
Hi, this is Chris. So I've got a question for the guest. He's done a great job of outlining the problem and defining it, but of course anyone can define a problem. And, you know, it's 2016 now, and we have well over $1 trillion worth of probably large companies. What does he propose, even in theory, if there was the political willpower to do so, to solve this problem?
Well, thanks, Chris, for that question and that opportunity. What we need to do is look at, on a case-by-case basis, different markets where you have huge degrees of concentrated ownership. There are some kinds of things that want to be big and that are best done when they are big, right? It wouldn't make sense to have a railroad that only ran 3 or 4 miles, and then you had to unload the train and put it on another railroad and take another 3 or 4 miles, right? There's areas of the economy where things should be big. But there are other areas where they don't need to be big, where things are much better done on a small scale. So there's not a single answer about how big any given corporation should be. It depends on what area of the economy we're talking about. But if we're talking about a company like Amazon, for example, Amazon not only has gigantic market share that is threatening entrepreneurial opportunity for all kinds of Americans who cannot compete against Amazon, mm-hmm. or who compete on its platform and are basically enslaved by its algorithms, right? Also, unlike anything that's ever been in American history before, you know, Amazon is competing against its own customers. The very people that have their little shops on Amazon, right, are competing against Amazon. And if you think about it, on the publishing side, Amazon is simultaneously the world's largest bookstore, right, and also a publisher, right? And so it has this vertical integration that, again, would have been completely illegal. No company could ever get close to this, right? It'd be like John D. Rockefeller not only owning oil refineries everywhere, but owning all the railroads, all the stores, right, all the distribution channels, right? So what do you do about something like that? Well, you might have a solution in which you say, it's great for Amazon to be in the book business, right? We all like buying books from Amazon. It's very convenient, right? But you can't also be a publisher, right? Or you can't also be a distributor of it. I mean, Amazon now is actually in the logistics business, right? It's in the manufacturing business. It's like making its own store batteries that it sells. So at some point, you just look at that and say, you know what? It's great what you do. You need to be 5 different companies. So, I mean, I hope that gives you a flavor of the kind of thing that we have to look at. The other larger point I would make is that we're under the thrall of the idea that these kind of competition policies should be basically done in the name of getting cheaper prices to more people for more stuff, right? And, you know, it's important that we have not overpay for stuff. But there's a lot more at stake, and previous generations understood this very well, that we need, for reasons other than just cheap prices, right, to create an environment in which we have abundant entrepreneurial activity going on, that local communities have abundant local ownership of their local economies and aren't colonized by distant forces. So in many cases, you know, we might decide, oh, you know what, breaking up this gigantic platform monopoly might lead to somewhat higher prices, but it will also lead to freer citizens and to more vibrant communities that have more autonomy and control of their own destiny, and where the key decisions about life are made in the community rather than in distant capitals.
And would it lead to an explosion of jobs, Philip?
Well, I think it would too, because one thing that happens to if you work in a monopolizing industry, right, instead of being able to sell your labor to any number of employers who are competing, right, for your services, there's just one company that you can sell your services to. And so I think that also the monopolization is a huge part of the inequality story. It's a huge part of why wages have been stagnant, because many of us work in fields where there's fewer and fewer, there's less and less competition for our services, our labor, because there's ever more concentrated ownership.
Chris, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Lori in Viroqua. Hi.
Hi. Calling from the colonies of rural America. Would you please talk about concentration in agriculture? Seeds, chemicals, beef packing, all the meat, all the dairy, everything is controlled by a handful of companies, ever more concentrated. You know, they're selling to each other right now as we speak. They found collusion in what it was, Cargill and fixing the price of lysine or whatever. You know, if they're knowing it, you know, if they're doing it in lysine, they're doing it in everything else, and it was just a fine. No one talks about it. Obama administration looked at it when he first came into power, and nothing happened. So please.
Thanks, Lori.
Yeah, and that's right. And we didn't mention Monsanto, right? What's happening to railroads, which are very important to farmers to get your grain to market, right? We have four railroads left in the United States, basically, right? Bill Gates owns 25% of the railroads in the United States.
Does he really?
And Warren Buffett owns the other 25%.
Wow.
I just took a train from Seattle to Chicago the other day through Wisconsin, and I was on the rails the whole time of a railroad owned by Warren Buffett.
Remarkable.
And if you live in any of those states between Chicago and Seattle, and you want to ship grain anywhere, you have to take Warren Buffett's price. You know, he tells you what it costs, right?
I'm wondering why it is, Philip, when you hear from people, particularly during election years, we've heard from so many small business people this phrase, excessive regulations on business, excessive regulations. It's been a mantra of a Republican platform for a long, long time. Why is it that small businesses wouldn't see what you're talking about right now as one of the real reasons that they're going out of business, that they're suffering? It's not just regulations for environmental controls that they have to follow. It's something else, but nobody's seeing that.
Yeah, well, this is part of the cognitive capture that has happened in our generation. There are plenty of small-scale business people who know darn well what's going on. You know, if you're trying to run a shop on Etsy or Amazon, you don't need me to tell you how vulnerable you now are to those kind of concentrated powers. Mm-hmm. But right, we don't even really have the vocabulary to talk about it. We used to, but various folks redefine terms. So we talk in terms of free markets, right? Free market is something that's different than a regulated market. Well, you know, prior to the 1970s, both liberals and conservatives wouldn't even know what you're talking about, right, with that, right? The way they would look at it is they would say, well, we have a choice, right? We can regulate competition with a comparatively small government, or we can regulate monopolies with a big government. And there were debates in previous generations. The presidential debate of 1912 between Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt and Howard Taft that's basically what the argument was about. And Wilson won, and what that meant was we adopted a platform that was in place really until the 1970s that said, to the extent possible, we're going to manage competition rather than manage monopolies, right? We're going to use government to make sure that we maximize competition in markets, and that will be what regulates prices and production and all that. Competition, capitalism, right? And then in some cases, like maybe telephones and other places, we'll use big government to regulate big monopolies. And that's the choice that's really still in front of us. That's an eternal one. But we don't really even have the language to talk about it. I don't know, you know, is that a conservative or a liberal idea, right? It's in historically, these ideas were in opposition to socialism. Socialism would be really big government where we redistribute income and opportunity, you know, through political, purely political means, right? But the all-American approach was, no, that's not what we do. We use government to make sure that markets are effective and competitive. And to do that, though, we need to rigorously enforce antitrust. That doesn't mean you're pro-government. That means you're pro-capitalist. But anyway, that's why it's hard to talk about.
Thanks, Larry, very much for your call. Let's go to Joanne in Reedsburg next. Hi, Joanne.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is about those of us who are middle class, and most of us now, unlike in the 50s and 60s, have skin in the game where the stock market is concerned. They've got 401k plans. And all of us.
Yeah, Joanne, I'm sorry. You have an important call, and I just can't hear you. If you could just try calling us back again, we'll put you right through. But we just can't hear what you're saying. So thank you for calling again. Victor in West Dallas, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hey,
you know, I've been hearing a lot about the wages. You know, there's a lot of other problems we have why companies are going. I'll give you an example. Many companies don't have where you have state unemployment matching Social Security, matching taxes, OSHA, and plus all the other environmental regulations we have. A lot of countries don't have that, and that's what's causing also many companies to go overseas.
You agree with that, Philip?
Well, there's such a thing as boneheaded bad regulation, but in general, we have less regulation today than we did 30 years ago. I mean, in the late 70s, for example, you couldn't take a ride on an airplane without the government deciding where the plane was going to go, what the price of the fare was going to be, right? That was all controlled. You couldn't ship a package, right? The government had what amazingly more coercive and controlling of the economy through regulation. If you were a bank, you couldn't even branch out into the next county, right, without government permission. So. I take the point that we have a lot of, boneheaded regulation. We always need to be vigilant about that. It's also true that monopolies themselves often welcome regulation because they're the only ones that can afford to comply with the regulation. You see this in agriculture a lot of times, right, where it's only the biggest producers that can actually afford to make a USDA-compliant slaughterhouse or kitchen. Right. And so oftentimes the real politics of this is the big monopolies are in Washington pushing for big regulation because they know that will keep the small scale entrepreneurial producers out of the market and leave competition in under their control. So it's not always what it seems when it comes to regulation.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you'd like to join this conversation with Philip Longman, senior editor of the Washington Monthly, wrote a very interesting piece that appears in the November-December issue of the Washington Monthly, which is what we're talking about this hour of the program, How to Make Conservatism Great Again. And that's what's on the table here. We have phone lines open for you. Let's go back to the Reformicons. I don't know if there are any ideas that are as big as antitrust, but the Reformicons, you write, put forward specific and practical, if rather small, ideas, some policy proposals. Let's talk about these mobility grants, providing workers who are having a hard time to make a living wage in America with the money they need to move to a thriving area where there are jobs. Is that a great idea?
I guess it's something to think about. To me, the greater thing is to figure out why is there such disparity in wages in the United States regionally anymore. I mean, one of the things that's amazing to people when it's pointed out to them, right, is in the late 1960s, the average worker in St. Louis or Milwaukee or Davenport, Iowa, or Memphis, right, earned roughly the same amount as the average worker in New York City, right?
Ooh.
We had real regional equality, and it hadn't always been that way. We had policies going back to after the Civil War where we consciously adopted policies to try and equalize economic development and the standard of living across the continent. And then we abandoned those policies in the 70s. And guess what happened, right? So now people in a handful of coastal cities have basically harvested all of the growth that the country has experienced in the last 20 years, right? So by now, the per capita income in cities like New York and Washington, D.C. and Seattle and San Francisco and Los Angeles is 30-40% what the country's average is, whereas just two generations ago, there was pretty much a single American standard of living regionally. So that's why I think, well, that's very nice that you want to create a little program so some guy that's trying to hold on in Milwaukee can maybe get the bus fare to move to Palo Alto, California, and try and start a new life. But it seems to me kind of completely inadequate,
right,
to the larger problem, right?
Well, and then what happens to Milwaukee, right?
Well, yeah, that too, right? Or so much of the Midwest is especially the upper Midwest, is you know, has really great educational systems, you know, just leads the nation in its production of human capital, right? And yet most of that human capital is finding that it has to move away from mom and dad to some coastal city to even have a chance, right?
Right.
Now, there's other things we can do. There's reasons why price of housing is so high in places like San Francisco.
It's outrageous. I don't know how anybody lives there.
Yeah, and there's things we could do about that, and that would be helpful, right, in order to... Because sometimes... the other thing that's strange about this, right, is historically Americans have been one of the most mobile people ever, right? And, of course, the largest migration was always from east to west. And when people moved from east to west, they were moving from lower wages to higher wages, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now we have huge flows of people moving from places like Manhattan to places like Texas, and when the flows are to Tampa or to Atlanta, right? And when people make that move, right, they're moving from a place that has high wages to a place that has lower wages, right? That's completely the opposite of the way it's been throughout most of American history, and obviously it's something wrong with that picture, right? Why are people doing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And partly it's because they're getting priced out of these super affluent cities that are where only monopolists can afford to live there anymore.
Mm. All right, Joanne is back. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about moving on to the solution to the problem. So if the antitrust laws are enforced and these huge companies are broken up, me as little Joe Schmo with a 401k that has investments in all these corporations, if they're broke, how would I see, you know, the average American so tied in with this now? Back in the 60s, when the antitrust laws were still being enforced, people like me didn't have access to the stock market in the way that we now do. So it seems like the repercussions for the average person would be really great. And I'm wondering if what you would have to say about that. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Joanne. Good question.
Hmm. In some cases, busting up monopolies would lead to those particular companies having lower stock prices. If you look at the way companies sell themselves to the stock market, right, if you look at their investor disclosures, basically what they're saying is, well, we've managed to corner this market or that market, and that's why you should buy our stock. Because having cornered this market, we will have high profits.
Right.
So that's good for the stock market. The question is that good for the country, right? Is that ultimately good for most Americans? And so I take the point that, you know, especially if you're, say, a retiree living on 401ks that are heavily invested in big pharma stocks, and we come and we bust up Big Pharma, and that could hurt. Mm. But on the other hand, it would lead to more jobs in biotech. It would probably lead to more innovation in higher tech because we'd have more competition, right? And in drugs now, we're getting to just a handful of gigantic drug companies that, you know, are barely competing against each other, just carving up these markets. So we've got very little innovation in biotech and in many other realms. So I take the point that there's short-term downside risk to some folks, but ultimately it can't be in the national interest over time to just have an ever more consolidated economy.
Thanks, Joanne. Doug Reedsburg, hi.
Hi. Actually, I got a couple things. One, how does this relate to trying to handle global companies that are outside of the bounds of just the United States? Two, is there any example of successfully breaking up any monopoly or monopolistic type company and it actually having a beneficial effect afterwards? And I forgot my third point, but that's enough.
Yeah, two is good. They're good. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
Right. So there's two questions there. Let me take the second one, which I think is easier, right? Has this ever worked? Well, yeah, it worked spectacularly. I mean, if nothing else, it's just the coincidence of the fact, right, that in coming into the early decades of the 20th century, we adopted these policies. What happened? Well, that's when America was great, right? That's when we had this gigantic increase in the standard of living from generation to generation, this huge, broadly shared prosperity. So the idea that these things are somehow antiquarian or getting in the way of progress is just not consistent with the facts. We broke up particular companies that, with benefit of hindsight, you say, well, that wasn't too smart, right? It's certainly possible to do this poorly. Right, the famous case in the late 40s where the Justice Department attacked the Pullman Company that made, you know, ran all the sleeper cars on the railroads, and you know, in another 10 years, the whole American rail passenger system would be out of business. So that was kind of a waste of time, right? But generally speaking, right, these sets of policies that basically maintain that markets in whatever corner you want to look were very competitive, right, was at least coincidental with this gigantic increase in mass prosperity. And guess what? At precisely the moment where we shifted those policy levers back and we said, we're not going to do antitrust anymore, we can now see with the benefit of hindsight is that's the inflection point where the American standard of living started to fall for most people. Right? That's when wages began to stagnate in the late 70s. So I think there's a very good case to make that this is sound economic policy.
What about this global situation? A lot of companies are all over the world.
Well, that is, you asked before, is like, why did people change their mind? And I said, well, it was fear of inflation, but I should have said, too, that it was, to some extent, fear of foreign competition, right? So, like, if you think about the big three automakers in Detroit, you know, before the 1970s, they faced virtually no competition from abroad. Mm-hmm. And then after the 1970s, they did. So maybe you don't need so much, antitrust. But, of course, what's happened now is we have these giant companies, these basically international trading companies that don't belong to any particular company or country at all, right? And they themselves now have achieved monopoly on global scale, right?
Right.
So, Apple has something like 80% of all profits in the cell phone business, right? And there isn't a single Apple product made in the United States. I mean, and so anyway, so it's complicated, but it's part of why too, right? We need trade policies that take into account unfair competition policies in other countries.
We need to pause for a moment and we'll continue our conversation. Philip Longman is our guest, senior editor of the Washington Monthly, and he's written a very important and lengthy essay in the November-December issue of the Washington Monthly, and it is titled, How to Make Conservatism Great Again. More from you in a moment on the Ideas Network. Judy is our next caller from Manitowish Waters. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Philip. Awesome program. I have a very specific example of regulations circling back to monopolies' influence on regulation. My husband has a company. It one of the items in his product line requires glass and Energy Star certification. So what has happened over the last, say, 5 years, maybe 10 years, is that glass is being made with, repeated improvements. So, for example, if you have a 0.2 R value, some company might improve it to 0.215. So in order to get the Energy Star certification that you can put on your product, you have to go through rigorous testing that costs thousands and thousands of dollars in order to allow you to use the Energy Star logo and certification. That's a really specific example, I believe, of how whoever is monitoring regulation, whoever the lobbyists are that are encouraging these regulations on behalf of the monopolies, the trickle-down effect of that, and I don't know if it's an intended consequence or unintended consequence, is that small businesses can no longer afford to be in business because they can't afford that testing. And that's why a lot of businesses, I think, are getting bought out, because they can no longer afford to do business.
Mm. Philip.
Right. Well, we have a amazing decline in the percent of the population that owns its own business anymore. Huge declines in entrepreneurship, and the reasons have to do with monopoly, and they have to do specifically through those kind of relationships, right? That contrary to the way our political rhetoric runs, and the conceptual boxes we think about, where there's regulation over here and free markets over there, right? Monopolists use regulation in order to keep folks, small businessmen, like sounds like your husband, you know, in line, maybe out of the business altogether, ultimately, right? And so what do you do about that, right? Well, you don't fulminate about, you know, what we need now is no government, right? What you do is you use government to cut those monopolists down to size. And that creates a political economy in which we don't have so much pressure from very powerful interests for boneheaded anti-competitive regulation.
And do you think, Philip, considering what happened in this election, that somehow what you've talked about for the last hour will indeed happen? Do you have faith that it will or not?
I, if you had asked me this 2 years ago, I would have said, no hell, no way. And maybe, you know, not in my lifetime, but there has been just such a sea change in people's understanding of this at sort of all levels, that I'd be very surprised if we don't adopt some of these policies, including under this administration. Now, it can be done poorly. With the Nixon administration, used antitrust to shake down corporations for
money,
campaign contributions,
yeah.
Right? And that's part of what gave antitrust a bad name, was its abuse by crooked politicians. So that could happen again. Donald Trump has threatened to use antitrust to kick back at Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post and Amazon, because, you know, Donald Trump says he's unhappy with the way the Washington Post has covered his campaign, so he's going to sick the antitrust division.
We'll see. We're out of time.
Antitrust. Okay.
Then, no, it's okay. You didn't know. Thanks, Philip, so much for being with us. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Philip Longman, senior editor of the Washington Monthly, will post the piece on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing and on-air production of our program this hour. Hour two We're going to leave Earth for a while and talk about the aliens are coming.